You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In Ahmad's War, Ahmad's Peace, NPR correspondent Michael Goldfarb remembers his friend and translator Ahmad Shorkat, an Iraqi Kurd who was tortured under Saddam Hussein and killed in Mosul after the overthrow of Saddam's regime. The book has just been reissued in paperback by Carolyn Graff, and I'm very pleased it has brought Michael Goldfarb to my show today. Hello.
Hello, Len.
When did you first meet Ahmad?
I literally met him the night before the war started. I had gone to northern Iraq, Kurdistan, to be an unembedded reporter. It was very important to me to be unembedded. And I'd gone with the brief of finding someone who had suffered under Saddam and making a documentary, a radio documentary, following the overthrow. We all knew that would happen through the eyes of someone who had suffered. And I didn't know who that person would be, but I knew there was no shortage of them. I met this guy in a hotel, desperately looking for a translator. All the good translators had been taken. And it turned out that he was the guy that I was actually looking for.
Well, how long before you realized that he was the guy?
Well, actually, probably about an hour, because after we'd gone through the small talk of, you know, is his English good enough and does he know enough about local politics to be able to help me, and he did, he insisted on showing me the citadel in Erbil, which is, they claim, is the oldest continually inhabited site on Earth. And as we were walking through, just getting to know you chat, he told me a bit about himself. He was living in internal exile in Erbil. He'd fled from Mosul. He'd been tortured several times. He had a big family. And he was, you know, clearly an intellectual, and we were the same age. And I began to think maybe it should be him. But he was like the first guy I met, and that, you know.
Well, you must have been intrigued when the discussion turned to Faulkner.
Yeah, that was something that, in fact, the reason I gave him the job was his English was idiosyncratic, to be sure. I mean, I understood everything he told me, but you had to kind of retranslate it from time to time. But I was, you know, asking him, doing the job interview questions. And in the middle of it, he just turned it around on me and said, do you know William Faulkner? And I said, well, you know, not personally, of course, but I know his work. And he went on. We started talking about The Sound and the Fury, which he had read very closely. And
one of the hardest of all the Faulkner books to read.
And as years have gone by, I've convinced that he in a sense was self-educated in English. I mean, he studied in English at university, but it was academic textbooks. And he learned to speak English from what he read rather than hearing it in a conversational way. And I'm convinced that reading difficult work like Faulkner actually informed his quite remarkable syntax and usage.
Now, you hadn't gone to replace Anne Garrels. You were going to do something different there.
Entirely different. I was working for Inside Out, which was the documentary program of WBUR. It's distributed around the public radio system. And I was there specifically to make the kind of big takeout that daily journalists, frankly, don't have time to do. You know, if you have to file, as Anne does, you know, every day, five times a day, on breaking news, you don't really get the opportunity to sit back and absorb.
But there's always the problem of parachuting into a place and not knowing much about the area's history and culture. Did you hope to learn all of this from a translator?
Well, yeah, and I had been there in 96 when I was still working directly for the network, for NPR, out of London. There was a bout of fighting between the two main Kurdish factions. Now they're political parties, but basically they were factions, the KDP and the PUK. And in an astonishing move, which says a lot about Iraqi politics and is worth understanding if you want to know what the prospects for this new government are. Maqsood Barzani had invited Saddam to send his army over the ceasefire line into the Kurdish safe area to help him fight Jalal Talabani. Now, this is 1996, and the Anfal campaign was not even 10 years in the past. The genocide at Halabja had happened, And when the word got out, I mean, the fact that the Kurds were having civil war was nothing. The fact that one faction had reached out to Saddam and said, help me, well, the international press went. And I had some knowledge of the place.
Are you surprised that that's largely been forgotten? Today, we think of the Kurds as a unified group. And it's the Kurds and the Sunnis who are concerned about Shiite power.
You know something? This is... When I was researching the book and looking back into the whole history of Iraq from the time my friend was born to the time he was murdered, the Sunni-Shia Kurd thing in all the great textbooks that have been written doesn't turn up. I mean, it's there, but the rival factions are pan-Arab factions. There's communists, there's socialists, and they were multi-ethnic, multi-sectarian parties. And this notion that it's a tripartite state is very much a post-war notion, and I believe that Washington policymakers, because they don't do complexity, and Iraq is a remarkably complex place, we got a three-sided problem that we can handle and we can analyze. The Kurds today, after that bout of fighting in 96, the Clinton administration brought Talabani and Barzani together and cracked their skulls and said, you know, we've been giving you money, and you're not going to get any more money, so you sort this out. The fight was over smugglers' taxes of oil and a bunch of other stuff out of Iraq through Turkey. And they took the lesson, and from the time they signed a memo of understanding and agreement, American money started going in the late 90s and really began to make a difference to what is had been an exceptionally impoverished part of Iraq, impoverished intentionally by Saddam. But today, you know, they do present a united front. Jalal Talabani impressed me during the war when I had an opportunity to spend time in his part of Kurdistan. He's actually a political leader. He may not be the cleanest guy around, but he does know how to organize a society and make the beginnings of civil society that function. So the fact that he's president is actually quite a good thing. But, you know, in Iraq, politics is about the present. Expedience, pragmatism, and the pursuit of power. And if you can get power by talking to Saddam, one Kurdish faction did. If you can get power, and these are what these negotiations are about, it's about figuring out who's going to really have the power. And what's happening, what has happened since the overthrow, is all these guys who are the senior politicians, many of them, you know, practiced politics under Saddam. They just wait to be told what to do. And so they wait for Zalmay Khalilzad and before him John Negroponte and before him Jerry Bremer to say, this is what we want to do. Because they know that basically the policy is still coming out of Washington. And so what's going on now, I'm convinced, is you will, you know, when the power finally devolves truly to Iraqis, you'll see all kinds of new alliances. And you may begin to see less of this Sunni Shia Kurd definition of identity.
My guest is Michael Goldfarb of NPR. He took some time off from his work as a broadcaster to write the book Ahmad's War, Ahmad's Peace, Surviving Under Saddam, Dying in the New Iraq, which was a New York Times notable book last year when it was released in hardcover. It's now available in paperback from Carroll and Graf. And Ahmad, were you the first boss he had as a translator?
No. He'd worked briefly for the Wall Street Journal.
What had he done before this all happened?
Well, he'd done a lot. He was trained as a scientist and was a lecturer in anatomy at the University of Mosul's medical school. It was like many post-colonial bright middle-class, working-class kids, the state steered their best and brightest into the sciences because they needed to build up that kind of human capital. They didn't have it. But his avocation was literature. So by day, he was a lecturer in anatomy, and he would gather his medical students, and then they'd go down to the local Poets Cafe in Mosul, and he would give lectures, proper literature lectures, on poetry, on foreign literature, on Arabic literature, in the hopes of broadening their own sense of their own humanity. And that went on until he was 35, and he had resisted the state's attempts to stop these classes. They were, you know, he was told over and over again by the Ba'ath regime, you don't do this. You know, you are a science teacher. You don't talk about these things. You don't need to talk about
these things. Did they see it as a threat?
Yeah, of course they saw it as a threat. I'm not sure that they even understood the threat. What they saw was a nonconformist, someone who, I know what he thought of these people. He thought they were very stupid and couldn't understand the messages that he was able to convey about, he loved love poetry. He thought he was a great romantic figure. And he would tell these kids, you know, like, look at the universal in this poetry about falling in love and that poetry about, we all feel the same. We're all one humanity. And that, in that context, is a very radical and threatening thing. But he didn't think they were smart enough to get it. He just thought he was someone who was disobeying rules.
But, and that led to him being tortured?
There were specific incidents that led to him being tortured.
And ironically, once in Abu Ghraib, wasn't it?
He was in Abu Ghraib at the very end. He spent most of his life trying to escape. He got away once.
I mean, leave the country.
Leave the country. He spent a year in Cairo in the late 70s, but found himself incredibly homesick. You know, I've lived abroad for the last 20 years. It isn't for everyone. You know, some people dream of escape, and then they make the escape, and they're ineluctably drawn back to their homeland. They can't get away from it. And he was one of those people. But at the very, very end, when everybody knew that, you know, the Americans were coming to overthrow Saddam, he jumped into a truck with a cousin who was running oil out to Jordan and tried to get away. And this was in the summer of 2002. And sure enough, you know, 4 miles from the Jordanian border at the last checkpoint, they get stopped by some, you know, Ba'ath cops or whatever. And he was carrying an article that he was going to publish in the Arab press as soon as he got out, calling on Saddam to step down and spare his people the indignity of another defeat. And these guys looked at him and said, thank you very much. You've made me rich. Because his name was on a list, and they got 5 million dinars, and my friend got shipped to Abu Ghraib. But it was at the time when Saddam released all the prisoners as a gesture to show he's not such a bad guy. So he didn't get tortured on that occasion, but he did get tortured on others. But for him, the single worst torture was when they forced him to retire, as he put it. They obliged me to retire as a teacher. He was 35 and he was dismissed. He could get no teaching work. And this was his life. He was a great teacher.
And he was living in internal exile, you said.
And he ran away.
Erbil is not the place he would have chosen.
No, Mosul is an hour's drive away. And Erbil was just over the line. He had family who couldn't come with him immediately. So they ended up settling there. He didn't really want to be there. It's a tough town to live in anyway. And he was unemployed for most of the subsequent time. And was supported by his children, which to him was a terrible insult. I mean, his son worked as a tailor. His daughter, his oldest daughter, who was unmarried, was working as a journalist, which is what he wanted to do. And in the end, he was actually her gopher. And this also hurt him very much. Then as the war came by, his English meant that he could find work. But it's not a full-time job, and so he would get hired, and then the reporter would leave town, and he would be without work.
My guest is Michael Goldfarb. I'm sure most of you recognize him as NPR's voice from London, but he spent time in Iraq after the war, and he has written a book called Ahmad's War, Ahmad's Peace, Surviving Under Saddam, Dying in the New Iraq, now available in paperback from Carroll and Graff. Stay with us for more. We're back with Michael Goldfarb. His book, Ahmad's War, Ahmad's Peace, Surviving Under Saddam, Dying in the New Iraq, is published by Carol Graff, now in paperback. You had to put your career on hold for a while, didn't you, to write this book?
It's called A Leave of Absence, but increasingly these are, I don't know, resented by the people who usually pay for your work. So I did, and but I would say I did do one more documentary when I went back to research the book, which was a year after the overthrow of Saddam, just to mark the changes in Iraq. And also to help his daughter try and find she's pretty certain who the murderer was, but try and get some justice, which was, I mean, to me, it's the story of how no one has ever paid for the crime of murdering my friend. Says everything that needs to be said about the state of civil society in Iraq today.
Well, you made this documentary called Ahmad's War, and what point in his life did that take us to?
It took us to the moment that the regime collapsed in Mosul, and my whole deal with him was, we will work together. He had actually said, if I agree to work with you, you can't fire me till the war is over.
But it was an odd position, because he's your translator, he's your subject.
It's everything.
But this is a little close, isn't it, for journalistic objectivity?
It was. And I would never say that this was the ideal, as we're taught. But it's close, I think, the way Sidney Shanberg and Dith Pran were close, except that story has a happy ending. And there's also, Lenny, it has to be said, I mean, this is a remarkably important historical event. I don't think people really have begun to understand just how important this action in Iraq and the ongoing failure of it is. And
For many years in the future?
For many years in the future. And to meet someone who would have been my friend in any case. I mean, like, as I say, we're the same age. We both started college in 1968. So, and it was amazing to this guy who grew up, he was Kurdish, but I mean, he grew up in an Arabic society. He grew up speaking Arabic as his first language. Kurdish was his second language. Should read the same books, think the same way on so many things, and we had been so different. I began to realize that one kind of objectivity went away. A different kind replaced it after he was murdered, which is there was the obligation to tell his story, and to tell his story in the way. One day he invited me and two other colleagues for lunch at his home, and it was very important to him to introduce his family to the Americans. And at one point in the lunch, I took out my tape recorder and started conducting an interview, because it was a good scene for a documentary. There was lots of food being eaten and lips smacking, and a lot of laughter. People, I mean, his household was full of laughter, which was amazing considering the suffering they'd been through.
And NPR loves those sounds.
Well, we've got to have those sounds. Come on. There was a silence, kind of awkward, because I didn't know how far to go. I mean, there's his family, right? I want to ask him about being tortured. And he just turned to me and said, "You can ask anything. No subject is forbidden in this house." And that's the way he brought his kids up. And literally, there was no subject forbidden. And so the fact that his sense of objectivity was that nothing was forbidden. Anything could be talked about. So in writing the book and in making the radio documentary, I felt if I stay to his view and stay as close to truth as I can and acknowledge that, you know, this is a personal connection, not hide it, then in a sense I'm honoring his sense of objectivity.
What did they hope to achieve by torturing him? Just to frighten him?
Yes.
They weren't looking for any information, were they?
Torture in a society like Iraq and in other totalitarian societies it's very rarely about extracting information. It is a tool of repression and fear. Absolutely.
Is it important for the person to be released to go out back and say, this is what they did to me, so others
absolutely
will understand?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what happened was a couple of years ago, I did an hour on the Medical Foundation for the Care of Victims of Torture, and I spoke to people who'd been tortured, but they came from all stratas. A guy was a real political activist in Chile in 73, so you understand that he was tortured. But then you meet, you know, a young woman who was just detained on her way out of Iraq, trying to escape from Iraq and was brutalized, or someone who survived the genocide in Rwanda, but who had been brutalized. So there are many reasons, but the deep and main reason for torture by the state is repression. And in Saddam's Iraq, because his wife's family had some money, he was a real prize, because they would, for whatever reason, he would go too far.
Some pretext? Would he publish something?
He'd publish something. He would, at one point, he refused to hand over, he had served his time in the army during the Iran-Iraq war. And at a certain point, they ran out of money very quickly, and Saddam sent out a call for everyone to hand in their gold so they could melt it down and have exchange and be able to buy more weaponry. And at the front, Ahmed tried to organize against this demand. You know, we're giving up our bodies. I'm not giving up my wife's gold. Gone. He was in Kirkuk for 6 months in the military prison, and that was his first serious bout of torture. And the thing was that his wife's family had some connections, and they had money. So they would take him, they would torture him, not kill him, and then wait for the ransom. And the ransom would arrive, and then he'd be released. And it was very useful for the regime. And it was not just for Ahmed, but for everyone. If you send somebody who used to be a guy who would stand up and say things and take a risk, and you return him to the community, and his body is broken, and his spirit is broken, that is a very effective tool.
Well, how is that received differently from what happened later with the things that Americans did at Abu Ghraib?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting question. When I contacted people in Iraq after Abu Ghraib, the last time I was there was in 2004, just before Seymour Hersh and CBS broke that story big. I was hearing it that there were very bad things, and in fact, a couple of the soldiers were dismissed from their positions just in advance of the scandal, because I guess the Pentagon knew they couldn't contain it. But the people in Iraq said, well, of course that's what they do. And they were much more sanguine about it than the American public, which, you know, was shocked and appalled, and the world, which was shocked and appalled. But in Iraq, this is what governments do. So they weren't all that surprised.
But the difference was that this was perceived as anti-Islamic, as opposed some of the humiliations seemed to be aimed at people of a different culture, which is different than Saddam. And we all understand the rules. Mm-hmm. I've lived in this country all my life. Obviously torture has a different kind significance.
But I think Lenny, the notion of Islamic, this notion of this political Islamic, and, you know, overthrowing Saddam, in 1991, if they'd overthrown Saddam, before political Islam had really got a hold of a whole generation of people, that wouldn't have been a question. It wouldn't have been seen that way. It would have been an insult to the Arab nation, but now it's an insult to Islam. And it shows how one of the things that the planners of this war did not consider was the degree to which the mindset has changed. And it's gone from a pan-Arab worldview. I mean, the program is essentially the same. It's essentially a centrally funded socialist ideal society. Everybody is taken care of from the center, and the notion of a free economy is slightly different. Now that's all gone. It's not pan-Arab. It's pan-Islamic. So there's an extra layer of, you know, this is received text as opposed to Marxism. And it changes the way things are discussed.
But when you're Kurds, you're not Arabs. So pan-Arab doesn't really mean
pan-Arab
the same thing to a Kurd.
No. But, yeah.
Well, I want to take a little break for just a moment and tell everyone that my guest is Michael Goldfarb. His book, Ahmad's War, Ahmad's Peace, Surviving Under Saddam, Dying in the New Iraq, is now available in paperback from Carolyn Graff. And another thing that I want to talk to you about for just a moment is whether you've read Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart or Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse 5, because we will be interviewing both authors during our BBC World Book Club tapings on April 28th and 29th. That's coming up the end of this week. Email a question for Chinua Achebe or Kurt Vonnegut to lopecho@wnyc.org, and I'll read your question to the author on the show. That's lopecho@wnyc.org. So let's get back to the whole idea of pan-Arab in a country that where not everyone was an Arab.
And Ahmed was a pan-Arabist.
And many of the Shiites are not Arabs either, because they're more related to Iranians.
No, they're not. I mean, this is – no one yet has satisfied me what is the most important thing in Iraq? Because is it your sect, Shia or Sunni, or is it your ethnicity? And what is the deciding factor in anyone's way of relating? And the idea that my friend, for example, got swept up in pan-Arabism. Now he's a Kurd, and this was at university. He was an activist. He, organized meetings and whatever, and was elected at the University of Mosul's Nasserite group. Nasser, being the first great pan-Arab leader trying to set up the United Arab Republic, and was told and was elected to go to the national conference in Baghdad, and then the head of the conference in Baghdad said, "This guy's a Kurd. How can he represent a pan-Arab party?" And it was the first time in his life as an activist that that barrier came down. And in fact, it was the first time he was arrested because basically he told his, what he thought, comrades, said, "But this is about social justice, it's about equality, this is about, taking control of the whole Middle East and moving beyond the colonial mentality and all that stuff." And they said, "Well, sorry, you're a great guy, but you're a Kurd." And he said, "Well," basically, he said, "forget it. I'll start my own party." And a week later, the secret police took him away. The Ba'ath had taken over the country a few months earlier. And, they took him away. They didn't torture him, but they gave him a good beating to let him know who was boss. And at the end of his interrogation, they said, "Who do you think denounced you?" It was the guys in the Pan-Arab group. So, he learned the hard way about this. But it's unbelievably complicated. And if you wanted to establish a society that was socially just and with great economic equality, and you were 18 in 1968, you were almost obligated to be a pan-Arabist, even if you were a Kurd.
Had his attitudes changed over the years? Was he in favor of the U.S.-British invasion?
Absolutely. It was something he couldn't believe was happening. And in that respect, something that's been lost as the situation has gone very sour and the U.S. has lost the respect of the people because of things like Abu Ghraib, but mostly because of the sheer ineptitude of the post-war organization. They can't guarantee security 3 years after. But there were many, many people who welcomed this and were grateful for a brief period. And then when the U.S. couldn't organize the society, they realized they'd been dumped from a frying pan of totalitarian dictatorship, into a fire of violent anarchy from which they've yet to escape.
And what did Ahmad think? Did he believe the country would be able to make the transition into democracy, whatever democracy means?
He knew it would take a lot of work.
Because he'd had plenty of experience, a personal experience that might make him more cynical than others.
He was just fired with the ideal that this unbelievable historical moment had happened for his country, and the slate had been wiped clean. And the day the regime collapsed in Mosul, he took me to his family, and I met people, and the city was being put to the sword by its own citizens. It's a sight that you can't see. You can't imagine what it's like when a city of 1.5 million people has no authority and everybody goes crazy. It was extraordinary. And we went down to the central square, and when we got there, the National Bank was being looted. A bunch of Kurdish Peshmerga had self-appointed themselves to be the local sheriffs. They were shooting at the Arabs who were looting the bank, and it was like a Hollywood scene. My friend suddenly starts getting involved in an argument with a little guy who was cursing out America. And I think my friend was embarrassed for me. It was all happening in Arabic. I didn't understand a word, except this little guy kept saying, "George Bush, George Bush." And you could tell what he was saying after George Bush was not polite words. And Ahmed started arguing with him, and suddenly there's a crowd of 20, 30 people, and the vibe was very bad. And my driver and myself, we literally each grabbed a shoulder and dragged him out of this crowd. Because, there was no authority. He could have been lynched. Nobody would have known. Everybody was carrying guns. And when he'd calmed down, we had a long talk, and he said to me, "I didn't think my people would act so strangely." And that was the beginning, I think, of the understanding that it would take a lot of work to erase this totalitarian nightmare from people's minds.
Do we have any idea of why he was killed?
His wife thinks it's old Baathists who, her line to me was, they made his life misery for 30 years and they finally killed him.
One of those revenge killings?
Just because they
saw
they
him
could,
as,
yeah.
And also he was your friend hanging out with Americans?
Yes, he hung out with Americans. He was funded by the Americans, and that was a bad thing. But he wrote some quite stirring stuff against the jihadis who were taking over. He wrote something, O courageous Mujahideen, you know better than I that the meaning of religion is peace and that God is peace and the salute of Islam is peace, meaning salam. And if you kill peace, you kill God. Meditate on that. And things like that will get you killed in Iraq. So I'm not convinced that it was Baathist. I think that it might have been a setup. And it was a setup because he was lured to the roof of his office building and shot down in the back. I mean, this wasn't somebody just walked up to him in a cafe. And I think that it was probably a combination because what he had been writing about, and this is in September and October 2003, before anyone had figured this out, he had seen guys who had tortured him hanging out with guys he knew from when he was in the Muslim Brotherhood. And he could see they were forming a union against the American occupation. And he was writing about this. And I think it was a combination hit that was ordered on him.
But since he had tried to get out of the country so many times, you would have thought he might have seen this as the best opportunity to get out. Did he feel he felt a greater mission?
He felt obligated. I mean, he had had a couple of months living in Poland in the early 70s, and he'd made it to Paris one weekend. And he used to talk about this as one of the great weekends of his life. And we stood on that rooftop, and he said, I want to travel again. I'll be able to go all these places. And then he stopped and said, but I can't go yet because I have all this work to do here. And in the end, he died trying to build a better society.
Ahmad's War, Ahmad's Peace, Surviving Under Saddam, Dying in the New Iraq, is now available in paperback from Carolyn Graf. Thank you so much, Michael Goldfarb, for being with us.
My pleasure, Lenny. Thank you. Thank you.